You know, one of the things that we have always discussed, and that my dad did every time we gathered like this for a holy day, and one of the things that I can help do in the way that we have things now, is to look at where we are in Bible prophecy, where we are as a nation, where we are as a church, where we are in the grand scheme of things. And of course, in order to figure out where we are and where we've come and where we're going, we have to understand where we came from. And a great deal of it is in the history of Israel. It is in the history of the United States. And the more I look into it, and the more I study, and the more I learn, the more I realize that the United States was really intended to be a latter-day foundation of Israel. We see a lot of things going wrong, and we talked about them here at this time and this place last year. Hard to believe where we were this time last year, but it is just incredible what has transpired in the space of 1 year's time. What I'm learning is that our founders realized, they discussed, they wrote, and they talked about the fact that this nation had to be set up, if it was to survive, in harmony with God's laws. And that is exactly what they attempted to do, was to formulate a constitution and a system of governance and of laws that exactly mirrored and was in exact harmony with the laws that God put into motion here on earth. It's something that my granddad talked about. You might, if some of the old timers may remember his discussion of the seven laws of success and how there are immutable laws in nature that order our universe and order our world that apply to every single thing in nature, including us, including our country, including our leaders. And to the degree that you have seen nations that were governed and were living and governing in harmony, in unison with God's laws, you've seen freedom, you've seen prosperity, you've seen happiness. And I would say that to the degree that we have seen those things, even in Western Europe, in England, and here in the United States, the degree of freedom, of prosperity, of liberty, has been in exact measure to the harmony with God's laws. But as soon as things begin to move in contravention to God's laws, even in temporal ways, it brings about failure and it brings about destruction. And we have seen it wherever, we have seen it throughout history. We have seen it throughout the world. We're grappling now here in the United States with the advent of socialism. And I guess you could get yourself pretty worked up when you think about how many sacrifices have been given, how much blood has been shed, how much treasure has been spent, how many lives have been lost to make sure that the socialist communistic system that is now being imposed on these United States would never come to our shores. And yet here we are. The whole story of ancient Israel shows how they prospered under good leadership and under harmony with God's laws, and when bad leaders came in and began to pass laws by their own whims, according to their own egos, according to their own sense of morality or whatever it was, the country got defeated. The country got broken into splinters and into shivers. Obviously, I'm not going to be able to get through many of these notes, but I wanted to say that we're not here to get involved in the machination of politics, and we don't. We don't get involved in political races, and we can't because of the strictures of the way we're founded and the strictures of the laws under which we operate under the way my dad set it up as a 501c3 corporation. We can literally get put out of business if we do get involved in the rough and tumble of politics, and therefore we don't. But we certainly are authorized, and actually our calling is to be aware of what is going on, to watch and to warn and to show the public exactly where we are and why that is the case. I've been approached by various ones at various times. I actually had two phone calls in just the last week saying, well, boy, you know, some of these guys are really getting out front on what's going on here in this country. And, I had a couple of examples given to me. One of a preacher, and I don't know if he is as forthrightly, abrasive as it was described to me, but the gentleman who called me said, boy, he is exposing the fact that we have got a Muslim president who is out to destroy this country, and why is the Church of God not out front on these kind of things? And boy, if your dad was alive, I know exactly what he'd be out there saying. You do? I said. You really do. You know exactly what he'd be out there saying, do you? Do you not recall that my dad was active during the Nixon years and the Carter years, and I might jump forward to the Clinton years, and there were a lot of credible stories, there were a lot of bogus laws, there were a lot of profane dealings that were taking place in the name of this nation. And my dad was quite circumspect in the way he handled that, particularly on television, and really stayed away from it in large part. Now, you may have heard some of what he said in sermons and some of the kinds of things that he could say in writing. I told this gentleman, do you not read the updates that I write every single week? Do you not read the monthly letters that are going out? And he said, well, yeah, but we need to be getting this out there to the public. Well, I know that this argument probably makes the rounds from time to time, and I really wasn't as quick on my feet as I wish I had been when I explained what I did to him. But it came to me after I hung up the phone, and I'd like to go ahead and sort of finish out right here, right now. And that is that those letters we're sending them to about 12,500 people per month. Only about 2,000 of them, if that many, are church members, are people who have been involved, who are keeping the Sabbath, who come to the feasts, and so forth and so on. The other 10,000 to 10,500 are people who are from the general public, who have responded to the telecast, who have requested a piece of literature, and who then do get the letter for a period of time, really for as long as they continue to stay responsive. So I wanted to go ahead and say that as a part of a disclaimer. You know, I see much of what's going on in our country right now as analogous and almost identical to what we saw transpire in the Worldwide Church of God. And I know a lot of people don't want to go back and, you know, castigate some of the things that were wrong back at that time. But I think we have an analogy here that is worth looking at. And I think it applies very directly to what we see going on a national scale right now. And that is that leaders came to power after my grandfather's passage, who did not believe in the core truths, in the core values, and the things that made the Church of God the Church of God. And they did not care about the consent of the governed. They did not care about the individual. They had their own agenda. And they didn't mind destroying the whole thing. And it has been destroyed. It is now splinters and shivers, and the whole thing has been liquidated, and I don't know what has become of all that. I have a feeling that there may be a heavy price in the afterlife, but that's not for me to decide. In a nutshell, we see the exact same thing that happened to that organization now taking place at the helm of the United States of America. And that is that we have leaders who have come to power who do not believe in the core fundamental values, in the truths on which this nation was founded. And therefore, if they are allowed to succeed, it will be destroyed. I don't know if this is the final act. I don't think that we dare go out and say the kind of things that this gentleman was trying to prompt me to go out and say in public on television or on the public airwaves. Because I don't know if this is the last act. Just as my dad knew that times were growing short, but he didn't know if Clinton was the last act. And he saw fit not to burn out, if I can use that term, or flame out or flare out or get us put out of business prematurely, because he thought there might be a need for a final witness and warning when the end time is actually upon us. I don't know how this thing is going to play out in every detail, and I don't think any of us do. I think that if this strategy that is being imposed against the will of the government, in contravention of the core values and the core philosophies on which our nation were founded, certainly would destroy it. But I don't know if that's going to happen that way. And I'm not sure if this present leadership would be anxious to be a player in the fulfillment of the prophecies that show the whole world getting involved under a great religious leader. And I think we have a pretty good idea where that's going to come from. We know all the people. I don't have to go back and explain the end time scenario to the people in this room, because I know you all have a real good feel for it. And I think a lot of people in the world have, when I say the world, I should say maybe in the Christian world, worldly Christian world, have a pretty good idea of what the end time scenario is. So I don't have to explain that in great detail. But I don't know at all if this is the final act. There very, very well may be a backlash against what's going on now that may lead us so far in the other direction that may turn out to take us into the scenario that you see described in the 24th chapter of the book of Matthew and in the chapters of Revelation. We know that we're in a lot of trouble in this country. We know that Israel, we just see just outrageous things that stand our hair up happening all the time. things that you just couldn't imagine could have ever transpired in the United States of America. You wouldn't think that you would ever have seen a leader of the United States bowing almost to the waist to some of the most virulent enemies of freedom, some of the most threatening enemies of the United States and of our values and of our philosophies. And yet there is another photograph that I saw a few weeks ago. Actually, it happened when Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel was visiting in the White House. And I saw our president in his face, actually leaning up over him with his finger like that. It was a black and white picture. It came in on the top of the Drudge Report. I didn't see it anywhere else. But isn't that something? Here is the one nation in the entirety of the Middle East that is central to Bible prophecy, who adheres to American values, who is the one and only bastion of freedom in all of the Middle East. And yet, those dictatorial rulers who enslave their people, we see our leaders bowing to the waist. But to the one ally who would have our back, and whose back we should have, we're giving him this. How does that work? It is in complete mirror image, in complete contravention to what we would expect, what we would have always known our country to be. Just a brief wrap-up. Israel is at odds with the current administration. In no uncertain terms, there is a real dearth of goodwill between the American, the United States administration, and the Israeli government. And it's putting us all in danger, but most of all, Israel. I don't know if you saw this last week, but one of the lieutenants to the the little wild man over there. Seems like the shorter they are, the bigger their egos. And their mouths are just huge. One of his lieutenants came out and said, if Israel makes a move against our nuclear facilities, we will destroy Israel within a week's time. Meanwhile, they're spinning more centrifuges, and almost every piece of news that comes out of Iran has something to do with the increased activity in their nuclear program. And we know that ultimately that poses a threat to the United States as well as Israel, because Iran is right in the thick of the whole terrorist movement in financing, where they're putting underground weapons into the hands of terrorists. And they will come after us, because after all, their religion demands it of them. Isn't it incredible that when they set out to kill innocent people, innocent bystanders, whether it be the Times Square thing or whether it be the Trade Tower thing or a jet airliner that was hijacked and was crashed into the Atlantic Ocean, they feel that they are committing an act of worship to their God when they kill innocent people. And it is so foreign to everything good and right. It is so foreign to everything that we believe and stand for as a people, as individuals. And yet, now there is a politically correct movement that says, no, we got to give them slack. We got to give them a break. And you know what? The real great danger to this country are people who want to save it, people who believe in its core values, people who want to stand for right. Boy, they're some dangerous people. These people that won't even litter when they go to a meeting, let alone put a pipe bomb in a public place, you know? Absolutely absurd. But that is the world that we live in. Do I need to tell you that socialism is an absolutely godless system? And how many of our forefathers have bled and died and given their all to make sure that it never came here? And now, here we are. We have been propelled into a period, I would say, of lamentations, and I have come upon a couple of lamentations, and I don't often go and quote and read, because I try to speak and reference things that you are all aware of and familiar with. But in Lamentations, there are a couple of passages here that just seem... Actually, you might read on your own time chapter 3, 42 through 47, but I'm going to go to chapter 4 and verse 12, because this is like reading the headlines right now. And you know this is true if you're keeping up, if you're reading and you're staying in touch with what's going on in the world. And we are fortunate now that we have a lot of help. We're not the only voice that sees that the United States is in a lot of trouble now. We're not the only ones. There are a lot of people who are in a position to put out a lot of information, who know what's going on. They don't know what we know, but they know a great bit of it. They know a great portion of it. And it seems like quite a few people are beginning to at least awake to some of those realities now. But in 4 verse 12, this sounds like you can read this off Newsmax.com or WorldNet Daily or an article in any number of papers, maybe the Washington Times. The kings of the earth and all the inhabitants of the world would not have believed that the adversary and the enemy should have entered into the gates of Jerusalem. And then it goes on about the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of priests, and have shed the blood of the just in the midst of her. Well, I think that we are the modern day reincarnation of Israel and of Jerusalem, if you will. And that is certainly the case here and now. I don't have the scripture here before me. I could ask Mike, and I'm sure he could probably tell me exactly where to find it, but I don't have to read it to you, because you've seen it and you know it. And that is that the one about the stranger within your gates shall get up very high, and you shall be brought low. I don't believe there is a racial component in that necessarily, because we know that Israel was something that was open to all people of all races in the New Testament, and that all of mankind has the opportunity to be a part of spiritual Israel. So anybody that wants to inject some kind of racial division into that is just way off base. It is a little disconcerting, is it not, to see how the race card is being played every which way on nearly every subject right now. I think there are real strong attempts to divide us along racial lines, to put us at odds with each other when really we're not at odds with each other, and a great many of us really want and are pulling for the exact same thing. It is interesting that about, 65 or 70% of the United States don't want our core values to be overturned, don't want to jump completely away from the core philosophies of freedom, of liberty, of the right to educate our children to God's truths. When the government seems to want to take our kids, get them into a classroom, and teach them that homosexuality is good, and teach them that the Muslim religion is somehow superior. Isn't it amazing that, and if you've been watching any of this debate that's been going on about the children's textbooks and this, the Texas School Board and all of that, that the powers that be in this country and the textbooks that they have been putting out for some years state the miracles of the Old Testament and the stories about Moses and the Red Sea and that kind of thing. Well, Moses claimed that this and that and the other happened. But then they tell the stories about Muhammad and the history of Islam, and they say that Allah created and commanded, and they treat that as actual fact, where they treat the truth of our history as fiction. And so they're trying to confuse the minds of the kids. It's no wonder they're so messed up by the time they reach teenage. And it's hard to get them back, isn't it? In the reading that I've been doing, I have seen that there were great care, there was great care given to the education of children and to teaching them of God's laws and of God's ways and of the right ways. And it seems like now our government and our country is trying to take that away from us. Oh boy, I am so discombobulated now. I had another one, and I think it may have been in the continuation there of Lamentations in chapter 4. It is. In verse 17, it says, "As for us, our eyes as yet fail for our vain help. In our watching, we have watched for a nation that could not save us." And I think I want to close on that theme. This nation cannot save us, and I don't think we can save it. And if there's anything that the apostles tried to tell us all throughout the New Testament, and that the Church of God in great measure and in great numbers has gotten away from this reality, and that is that salvation is not by group. Salvation is not by organization. Salvation is not by nation. And it is not by following somebody. And that New Testament makes it absolutely plain when it tells each and every one of us to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. It was a major theme of my dad over all those years. We think maybe if we could just get the right leadership, and boy, if they could just tell us the right things, and boy, if they could just herd us all into one big herd, one big group, boy, we could all just sail right on into the kingdom. But if there's anything that we're going to find out in the days and the years ahead, it is that ultimately it's wonderful for us to be of like mind and to be together as a church and as a group, and we need to respect that, and we need to to curry that. But ultimately, it all comes down to each and every one of us as individuals, because salvation obviously is not granted by group status or by affiliation or by nationality or by circumcision or all that, because the whole New Testament goes to making that clear. I am so sorry that I have to rush off. It just is almost a crime. But anyway, here we are. The schedules didn't mesh, and this is the last flight out. I'm so sorry to have to say goodbye, but it's been a terrific weekend. I've enjoyed every minute that I've had with you, and I hope likewise is the case. I was able to come this morning, and Dr. Ricks and Natalie have done a great job in organizing the weekend, and sure appreciate all that all of you have contributed to this. Thank you so much. Godspeed, and I hope we'll all be here with more time to spend with each other this time next year. Bye-bye.
Good afternoon, everybody. I feel like I'm the hors d'oeuvre, and you guys are halfway full. But we'll give it a good shot anyway. I'd like to say hi on behalf of Bettendorf, Iowa. We live in Illinois, but we go about an hour's north drive up there by the Mississippi River. And today we normally have an outdoor service. We rent a little pavilion where people would have a picnic lunch. And usually it's good weather. Once in a while you get a bad weather day, but we've dealt with it every year for probably 5 years. I'm not so sure they send their greetings because they're a little upset with me. The song leader's not there, and one of the sermonettes is missing, and special music came here. So hopefully they're getting along okay. I know they were reluctant to let us go. I know I also cooked lunch on the grill, so and they're going to have steaks this year, which I think is their way of getting back at me for leaving. Because I like steaks. All joking aside, let me tell you about a member in our congregation we're very happy to see come in. We have a guy named Charlie Stout, and he's probably 70, in that range somewhere. And he's near the end of his promised life, let's call it that. His wife is a non-believer Baptist, and he's come into the church, and he really wants to understand everything. And he was baptized maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. And his question a couple weeks ago in services was, well, how do I know I have the Holy Spirit? And we're like, well, Charlie, you have it. You know, you're good. I mean, he asks good questions. He's very gentle. He's mild-mannered. He's intelligent. I mean, everybody likes him. And I just couldn't believe he was asking the question. So then I got to thinking, well, you know, how do you explain to Charlie? You know, you don't see it. Like, if you notice, it'd be convenient if this is how it was for everybody. You know, you got a little thing above you. Like, oh, there's a little flame, and then there's the big flame. It's like, well, you know, you got a little flame. You're just starting out, and you're moving on it. But he's battling cancer right now, lower intestine. So if you could send a silent prayer for Charlie, I know he would appreciate it. He does have a good prognosis. He's going through chemotherapy treatments. He's on his third one. So he's been missing a lot of services because of his illness. But we do keep in touch, and so far, so good kind of thing. So, what do we have to do to have a good garden? And I asked myself that. We just recently put one in at our house. And the first thing you have to have is a seed, or seeds. Hopefully you have more than one. It's going to be a small garden. Let's turn to Luke 8. And we'll start there in verse 4. And I do plan to give this sermonette to Charlie when he does make it back to services. Normally I would practice on a small group and then bring it to the big group, but I'm doing things different. So let's start in chapter 8 and verse 4. And when much people were gathered together and were come to him out of every city, he spoke by a parable. A sower went out to sow his seed, and as he sowed, some fell by the wayside, and it was trodden down, and the fowls of the air devoured it. And some fell upon a rock, and as soon as it was sprung up, it withered away, because it lacked moisture. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up with it and choked it. And other fell on good ground and sprang up, and bear fruit a hundredfold. And when he had said these things, he cried, He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Also in Matthew 13, there's a similar account, but we're not going to turn there. But if you're interested in comparing notes, it's a little bit different. But for the gist, it's about the same. God has a garden, and the Holy Spirit is like a garden. And if cared for, it will grow. Like I mentioned, we have a garden at our house. We moved in recently, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and we wanted to have a garden. And we had a very small house where we were before, so the garden was more like a flower bed with a couple strawberries. So we did the work. We tilled, or I tilled. Missy did the work on the planting. I have no interest in that part, but I don't mind doing the physical labor. So we added fertilizer and peat moss to ours. We planted the seeds in rows. We watered it, we pulled the weeds, and at the end of the season, we did harvest the crop. And that's how we grow a garden. I know there's probably ways farmers grow with thousands of acres might differ from that a little bit, but small home garden, that's how we did it. How can we use those six steps of growing a garden with the seed that God planted in us? Let's take a look real quick. The tilling part, the best spot is chosen when you till. We chose a spot where we could reach water, where the sunlight would hit it, and we're going to give ourselves the best chance at a fruitful garden. So the soil was ready. So that was step one for us. Step two, I mentioned, was the fertilizer. And I look at that as it's the studying and the learning and the desire to know more. Charlie has that desire. He wants to know everything. And we have a Bible study before services. It's an hour long, sometimes an hour and a half. Once in a while, it gets to 2 hours. But we have all afternoon, so we go with it. And sometimes you get some hard questions that you're not prepared for, and you have to come back next week with some answers. But it's good because it enforces you to learn more. The third thing is planting. Once we have the garden spot chosen, we fertilize, we're going to plant. And I look at the planting, to me, it's meditating, or it's thinking about what we are learning and dwelling on it. I have an older car when I drive to work. It does not have a radio anymore, or the antenna is broke, so therefore I have to be right next to a town to get any kind of music. At first I thought this was a bad thing. Now I'm starting to kind of look forward to it because I have a half-hour drive, and I get to think, and a lot of sermonettes are given. So I get time to kind of work on things, and half-hour there, half-hour back, and you chew on things, and it works for me. So I do most of my meditating while I'm driving. Step four was watering, and I look at the watering as kind of like praying to God. You're going to make things grow. You're asking for understanding. You're asking for the strength to be better, and you're praying for others. The fifth step was the pulling the weeds. A lot of people probably are going to get this one. It's removing sin, or removing what's going to choke out your garden or your fruit. It's trying to. We should be fighters. On my way down here, we took the car with the radio, which was nice for 6.5 hours. Don't need to meditate that long. Unfortunately, the air conditioner went out, so I got a sunburn on one side here, but I think I'm going to be okay. There was a commercial on the radio that I thought was kind of funny, and it was talking about a little dog who got a hold of this guy's shoe or of some kind, and his name was Little Shredder. And I pictured his little poodle, and it was just tearing it apart. But I was thinking, well, you know what? If we're going to pull weeds, or we're going to remove sin from our lives, shouldn't we do it like a little shredder and not just like, get away, go, and then that's it? You know, I mean, really work at it. Dig it out. Make sure it doesn't come back. I mean, so for me, a little shredder works for me. I'm going to try to keep that one. And the sixth step was harvest. The fruit develops, and it can be used. So my question would be, after the harvest, what fruit develops from this harvest that we're talking about? Let's turn to Galatians 5, 22. Actually, you probably don't have to turn there. Most of you know exactly what it says there. It's the fruit of the Spirit. I'm going to turn there. My Bible has a nice little summary of them, and some of them are listed, and you're like, well, what exactly is that? So I'm going to read you that part real quick. The one point I want to point out, it says fruit of the Spirit. It doesn't say fruits. Fruit would inquire a singular. So to have the fruit of the Spirit, you have to have these nine things. And a lot of people may think, hey, I just need one or two of these, and this other one, it might not be as important. I'll just work on what I'm good at. But as fruit on a tree or a fruit in a garden takes time to grow and mature, so the fruit of the Spirit, as fruit on a tree takes time to grow or garden to grow and mature, so the Spirit does not cultivate these virtues in the believer's life overnight. Love is the willing, sacrificial giving of oneself for the benefit of another without thought of return. Joy is gladness of heart. Peace is tranquility of mind, freeing one from worry and fear. Long-suffering is patience with others, the opposite of a short temper, a disposition quietly bearing injury. And gentleness is kindness. And goodness is generosity. And then faith. Here is, mine says dependability. There's more to faith than just dependability. Meekness is gentleness. That is a courtesy and consideration in one's relations with others. Temperance is self-control. That is the ability to harness and control one's passions and lust. So there's the nine fruits of the Spirit. I wanted to mention that it was singular and that all nine are needed to have the fruit. The church had an issue back in the New Testament. Let's turn one more place. 1 Corinthians 3. And there was an issue here, and it's going to help pull my illustration together. Or if it doesn't, it'll be my fault because I didn't do it right. It seemed good last night while I was making notes, though. 1 Corinthians 3, we'll start in, I'll paraphrase a little bit. We'll start in verse 5. Basically, we're stepping into the middle of it a little bit, but Paul and Apollos were two ministers from different church areas, and the members of the two areas were kind of feuding a little bit over who had the better minister. So in verse 5, who then is Paul and who is Apollos, but ministers by whom you believed, even as the Lord gave to every man. And I have planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither is he that planteth anything, neither he that watereth, but God that giveth the increase. Now he that planteth and he that watereth are one, and every man shall receive his own reward according to his own labor. And here's the part I want to focus on, verse 9. For we are laborers together with God. We all have roles to play. Some are ministers, some are deacons, local elders, some are lay members. We all have our job and our duties. And you are God's husbandry. The word for husbandry is also field. You could look at garden. You are God's building. It is God's church, and we all labor together here. We are God's. We're God's field. We are God's garden. And as time grows short, the weeds will try to creep in. Stay strong. And from up here, I can see a small piece of God's garden. And it's beautiful.